Hello. I'm so excited to be here. It's crazy. It's just exciting. So thank you for coming. I'm glad you're here. So we're going to talk today about HTML5 APIs and how they're going to change the world. They're going to change what the web is, I really believe. And I'm hoping that a lot of you are here as designers or business people, as strategists or project owners, because I feel like there are some really great developers who've been inventing these APIs for HTML and for the browser, but the rest of us don't really know what they are yet. And we're not going to make anything cool out of them if the rest of us don't know what they are. We really need the whole team to know. It feels like such an exciting time, everything is changing and everything's becoming something different. So I'm hoping to introduce you to some of these things today. My name is Jen Simmons. The hashtag for this is HTML5 APIs. I've been a designer since, I don't know, a long time. Originally in theater, then I started doing a lot of print, then I started doing a lot of web, back when it was a webmaster, right? And I think understanding kind of where we've come from and where we're going helps us to really get a sense of what's ahead, what's going to be coming up. I have a podcast called The Web Ahead, where we talk a lot about the future and what things are happening in the future. If you like this talk, you should check out this podcast. And I live in New York, where we take the subways a lot. I've lived there about 3.5, 4 years. And at first, you know, I'm like, I grew up in a city. I know how to take the subway, no problem. Here I am, I'm taking the, the 2-3. I'll get on the subway. And then this happens. And the 4 shows up. And when I first got to New York, it was like, what the heck? The 4, why is the 4 on the 2-3 track? If you get to know the maps, you're like, the 4 is the green one, and the 2-3 is the red one. And if the green train is going down the red tracks, where am I going? Where's this train going to take me? Am I accidentally going to get on this train and end up in a completely different part of the city? What never happens, though, is the B is not going to show up. The D is not going to show up. The F is not going to show up on the 4-5. Why? I grew up in D.C. where the metro is really quite simple, and it's even more simple in San Francisco where, I mean, look at that. It's just, you get on, you get off, right? These systems were designed and built later, maybe in the 60s or 70s, somewhere around there, while the New York subway was really started in the early 20th century, like 1904. And the reason that it ended up so chaotic and so crazy is because it was not designed by a governmental body who got together and figured out, like, okay, this is what we need to do. Let's plan it like this very carefully. It was created by 3 separate competing private companies. And each of them designed something that made a lot of sense. It was very simple. It was very like, here's our subway system. This grew into this. This was the first company, the Interborough Rapid Transit Company, the IRT. But meanwhile, came along a competing company that said, okay, well, we're gonna do it more better. We're going to put in stations, and we want you to take our train. And they were competing by redundancy, by having a lot of stops that are very close to where the other stops are, and being like, well, our train's better. Theirs are made out of metal. Ours are made out of wood. Look, ours are prettier. Sound familiar, right? Competing companies coming up with their own ideas about what the train should be. And then, like, this one's Brooklyn. They were like, we're just going to be in Brooklyn. And then we're just going to drop you off into Manhattan. Until they decided that they would expand into Manhattan. So then they were all in Manhattan, too. By 1939, this is a subway map where all 3 companies' lines are drawn on the map. There's slowly this idea of integration and wanting them to work together, but it takes some time. 1948, they're still drawing these maps with all of these subways, different subway lines, and color coding them, where yellow is one company, red is a company, blue is a company. So if you're a rider on the subway, you have this concept in your head of there being 3 separate lines, and you want to get together, you know, you want to know which line you're on. 1966, it's 25 years after they've put the subway systems together, and they're still drawing the map with these companies. And I think it must have been hard for people to understand. And, you know, it was the 60s, so they're like, okay, well, we're just going to make the map really, nice and neat. The map will be really neat. That's going to help people understand. If we draw all the lines straight, that didn't really work. So this is 1968. They drew it all chaotic again, but they're still emphasizing this idea. And my point here is the legacy of this old concept, this old idea that grew out of the reality that used to exist, that slowly stopped needing to exist. The reason you'll never see a letter train going down a number track is because the trains are different widths. The number trains were first, that was the IRT, and they're narrower. And the other two companies got folded into what's now called Division B to people who work for the MTA. And those are all the letter trains. And the cars are wider. So the wider cars don't fit down the narrow tracks. And if you drove the narrow cars down the wide tracks, you'd have a big dangerous gap between the car and the edge of the platform. It's interesting that the train tracks are the same because they used a standard. There was a standard. The idea of standards really came from trains. They standardized time in order to be able to take the train. They standardized train tracks. Standard gauge was kind of the first use of the word standard in this way that we now use to mean web standards, right? But even though there was a standard and these sort of details got worked out around, you know, how are the switches going to work? How can we get these trains to go from this tunnel to that tunnel? Let's close this station because we have too many over here. Let's dig a tunnel between these two stations so that now they're connected and you can walk between them. They still, 35, 40 years later, were emphasizing this idea to the users, to the riders. Eventually that did go away, and you look at the subway map today, there's really no evidence of that. But it took a really long time. And in part, I think it took time because it's steel, it's tunnels. They drilled tunnels underneath the densest, most populous city in the United States. It's very hard to move those tunnels around. But we don't make tunnels and steel. We make pixels. We make little bits of green, red, and blue on a screen. And there are some physical things involved with the web and with the internet. There are routers and switches and wires. You might have cable coming to your building right now and you want some fiber optic. They're going to have to come and drill a hole under the sidewalk and put down a new cable. But it's not nearly as hard. You may be going back to work and designing a new website. It's not nearly as hard to make changes to that website by moving around pixels as it is to move around the steel in the train system. But it's just interesting to me that there's this human quality that we kind of get stuck on what was in the past without really paying attention to why. And it's culturally hard to make a shift, even when the technology has moved on, even when things have moved on. So I'm going to talk about some of this in regards to HTML and in the browser and how the browser works, the ways that it was built for a certain reason, the ways that it's changed, hopefully to inspire you to have new visions of what's possible in the future and not necessarily just keep doing the same thing over and over. When the Wide World Web was first started, this is what Tim Berners-Lee said about it in 1994. The Wide World Web was developed to be a pool of human knowledge which would allow collaborators in remote sites to share their ideas and all aspects of a common project. The idea of the web was prompted by positive experience of a small homebrew personal hypertext system used for keeping track of personal information on a distributed project. Basically, the idea was, hey, there are a bunch of people, we're all over the internet, we want to work together on something. We want to share documents. We want to read each other's documents. We've been making a document and taking it and FTPing it over here where somebody can like anonymously FTP into the server, take a look at the document, right? Like what if we put it into a page? And we've been doing that with email and with Gopher and this and that, but let's come up. Here's another idea. Let's do it in this thing called the Wide World Web. We'll have links and we'll be able to click and read and click and read, and the clicking will be awesome. And it was awesome. It was so awesome that it became the most popular thing on the entire internet and made the internet be something that was a small group of, you know, geeks, nerds who knew computers to being something that, like, literally everybody uses that is disrupting every industry we have, every economy we have, every business model we have, and changing it into something else. So it was incredibly successful, right? But it was born out of this idea of hypertext, hypermedia, links, pages. And in order to do this, there were really three things that you needed to have a website and to have the technology running: a URL, an HTTP request, and some HTML. So for those of you who don't know what this is, here's a little lesson. There's my my mid-90s beautiful computer, the computer that the person surfing the web, and the web server. Person types in a URL into their browser. It sends what's called an HTTP request up to the server and says, hey, I need this thing. I need this example.com/mywebsite.html file. And the computer goes, okay, that's good, the server. It says, here, I got it for you. It sends it back down. And the browser starts to read it and says, oh, I need some CSS or JavaScript. That's what happens now, right? And those are HTTP more requests for more files. And then that stuff gets sent back down, right? So it's this action, up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. And each of these connections, it's almost like talking on a walkie-talkie. Like, hey, psh, you got the phone? You got that extension cord I need? Yeah, I do. Off, right? On, off, on, off. And you can see things like that if you use a tool, developer tool, and you look at, say, the New York Times page loading. You can see all of these HTTP requests, all these GET requests and POST requests and all this stuff. And you can see them in that little waterfall chart. You can see them start to come back in, how long each one took. These ones happened first. These other ones had to wait until those ones were done. Things can get really slow. It worked great, though. It worked great for stuff like this. But there are limitations. Remember this? There are limitations to HTTP. And we've been wanting it to be better and more for a long time. One limitation is that the page is static. It doesn't update itself. It's just sitting there, hanging out. Hi, I'm a page. I've been drawn. I have some images. Aren't you glad I'm here? You're reading me. That's cool. I'm hanging out. Not much happens. And one of the things that we've wanted to do, and we've started to do, and we found workarounds for doing, is to make the page update itself. So Facebook timeline, Twitter timeline are good examples, or Google Docs, where you've got a page open, and somehow it's going to change without you going to it again or refreshing the browser window. And many of these things that we've been doing have been succeeding. Here's Etherpad. Just in case you're not familiar with this kind of stuff, right? One person can start typing. Somebody else goes to the same URL. They start typing. We're all typing. We're all seeing each other's typing. It's pretty cool. There's a couple different ways, technologies that can be used to do this. One is called Comet, which is what this is using. There's others. Lots of times it's done with polling, long polling, which I think of like a two-year-old who wants a snack, who's like, hey, can I have some crackers? And you're like, no, wait a minute. Can I have some crackers? Can I have some crackers? The web page itself in the browser is like, psst, you got something for me, server? No, okay. Psst, you got something for me? No, okay. Hey, you got something for me? No, okay. So with the web page itself just keeps making an HTTP request every maybe half a second or 2 seconds, asking, got it, got it, got it, got it. And server's like, no, 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 no. Oh, yes, now I have something for you. It's very inefficient. Lots and lots and lots of HTTP requests are needed in order to make that happen. Because really the HTML, HTTP, URL system, what it kind of wants the web to be is this, is to be a big brochure rack and a series of pages. And that's not really what the web is going to be. It's not really that now, and it's really not going to be that in the future. This is what we've had, right? This is what we want. This is what we've been wanting, is an open connection, more like a phone call. If you and your friend are on the phone, and you just no one says anything, that's fine. Somebody says something, you hear it immediately. You didn't have to ask them if they're saying something. They didn't have to tell you that they're about to say something. It's just this open connection that just stays open. And that's really what WebSocket is. It's a connection between a web page and another web page, or a server and another server, or something and something else, that just hangs out and stays open. And if nothing's happening, then nothing's happening. If something starts to happen, then it happens. And it happens immediately, because the connection is just open. Now, WebSocket's not replacing HTTP. HTTP is pretty awesome, and it will continue to do exactly what it's doing for the next, whatever, 150, 300, 700 years. WebSocket really is a way to kind of augment that, to stack on top of that. It actually starts with an HTTP request and then upgrades the connection into a WebSocket connection. And you use it for certain things. It's truly bidirectional, full duplex, always open connection. And you can do stuff like this. This is a demo page that developers over at Kazing built. It shows you the stock ticker that's automatically updating, the New York Times, whatever's being posted there, whatever's coming in on Twitter. Down here, this graph, you can see it's being updated, and it's happening much more smoothly and much quicker than it might if it was using polling to do that. These are all things that you can do with the workaround technology, but are easier to do with WebSocket and more beautiful. It's really more natural to the technology itself. It will happen more easily. Here's another example where it's updating with stock prices. Meanwhile, this person who's in the window on the right, and these two windows can be on different computers, they could be on different sides of the planet, it could be two windows on the same computer. They're buying stock, and you can see over on the left in the first row, you can see that number 25, and as they start to buy something, it just immediately updates in the other window. This window on the left doesn't have to hang out and then be like, psst, you got something new? Hey, you got something new? Hey, you got something... It's just going to show up there as soon as it happens. But those things are a little boring. They're a little bit like what we're already doing. Like, what's the big deal? So it's a little faster, whatever. That's not exciting. This is where it starts to get exciting. So these are two windows. They're two browser windows. They each have this ball bouncing around. It's canvas. I don't know, some JavaScript technology. Most of this is all about JavaScript. The WebSocket connection doesn't actually do anything. It's just a connection. And then you send programming through it. You got to program all of that. But here, these two windows are now communicating through a WebSocket. And that ball is going from one window to the other window. Those are web pages. That's a website. Being the same URL, somebody went to that URL twice. So he's going to reset it and do it again. So imagine you got the two web, you know, example.com and example.com. You're at that URL. He's lining them up and could click on that red bar. And the ball's going to start going between the two pages. Totally different thing. Totally nothing like what we've been seeing today, right? Here's another demo. The web page is in the browser in the phone, and the web page is in the browser on a computer. It could be on a TV. And he's using this web page on the phone to drive the car, to make the car move, right? It's a little confusing because of this 3D jumping around this car. You're like, you just start to get it, and then the car jumps, and you're like, wait, what's going on? And there's a bunch of demos. You can play with these demos. They're at kazing.com/demo. There's a Frogger game, right, Frogger, that you can play. And then there's this game. Let me see if I can do this. We'll do the live, take the risk, do a live demo. So there's this game called Space Words, right? Come on, scroll. Well, so if you can, a couple people can play this, up to four. I'm going to open up a QR code reader in my browser. Let me see if I can... Wait, that wasn't the QR code. No, it's too far away. All right, so I'm looking at this QR code, photographing it. Come on, there we go. Opening the URL. Oh, I'm not connected to the internet. Come on. Well... If I could do it, I could. What would happen is I would shoot the QR code and it would open up the controller for this on my web site. And if there's anybody like in the front row that can do it, you can. If I knew how to scroll that window, I could do it too. But then you can sign in and you sit there and you play like an asteroids game, a lot like the car game. But it's asteroids; it's cooler. Look. So what can you do with WebSockets? You can do a lot of different things. Real-time updates of content on a single web page. Some of the examples we saw first are like that. Multiple people using the same web page, seeing each other's activity immediately. And it doesn't need to be activity that we've been used to, like typing characters, which technically is extremely simple. Typing characters is very easy for computers to handle. It can be something much, much more complicated, much richer than that. And other people will see it automatically. Or one person using multiple devices. It feels like with television, for example, there's been a lot of talk about TV and what's going on with TV and how's TV going to be changed forever and the television industry disrupted and it's going to be awesome. But we're waiting, right? We're waiting to see some of these things. It feels like you could go to a site like Hulu.com and instead of, like I live in New York. I don't have a television set, very small apartment. I just take my 27-inch awesome screen for work, slide it to the edge of my desk, open up Hulu, full screen it, and then back up like 5 feet and sit on my couch and watch TV. What if I could also open on my iPad the same exact window and somehow have the stuff going on where, you know, I could actually comment on the TV show or I could pause it? Or what if I want to watch that show with my friends who also use the internet and not broadcast cable television, but we want to watch it together? Right now, there's no way to watch the same video starting at this. You could be like, okay, you ready? 3, 2, 1, click. Instead, one person could hit play, and the other people could see the exact same movie at the same moment in time, so you're watching it together as if it were on regular broadcast television. And one person could pause it, and it would pause on the other person's TV screen. There's something about having multiple devices in your lap that's going to like this technology. So that's WebSocket, and if you want to learn more, one of the episodes of the Web Ahead, episode 5, Peter Lovers came on. He works for Kazing. He knows a lot more about the technical details than I do. So we talked for like an hour and a half about WebSocket, all kinds of details. If you're wondering how it works or how, if it's implemented in browsers yet, when can you start using it? What does it require? What do you need to make it work? Check that out. So then I want to talk about storage. So remember the good old days when you wanted to make a website. You would hand make HTML files, some JPEGs, some GIFs, some GIFs. You'd fight about whether it was GIF or GIF. And you needed to have some kind of coding program in order to edit those files, right? You needed to know how to write HTML. Maybe use Dreamweaver or some kind of WYSIWYG tool, and you clickety-click-click, and it would make code for you. But mostly, you needed to write your own code. And then you'd package all those files up, and you'd open up your favorite FTP application, and you would put them on your server, your little bitty server. That's how you made a website. That was Web 1.0. People would then go to your URL and get your website downloaded to their very odd-looking computer. Then things changed, where instead of putting finished HTML files on the server, where all the content was hard-coded into the HTML, you know, we went through this period of separating style from substance, separate the look and feel and put it in the CSS, and then keep your HTML as your markup. It feels like at this stage, we went into three pieces, where you separated your styling from your stuff, from your content. You'd have files, image files, movie files, all kinds of files, and you'd have code, whether that was Java or PHP or Ruby or whatever you wanted it to be, Perl. And then you had a database. And I feel like this was key to everything. The fact that there was a database on the server and the content would go into the database made all kinds of things possible. Because then you had magical robots, and your magical robots would run around, and they would grab content out of the database, they'd grab the code would tell them what to do, the code would make the robots turn on, and they would grab your files, and they would churn them out and turn them into HTML and other stuff and send it down the pipe to the person's computer. And remarkably, that would be customized. I remember the first time I went to Amazon.com, and I on the page, it said, like, "Hello, Jen." And my mind was like, what? somebody didn't just make that for me. Like, a robot made, a magical robot made that webpage just for me right now, right? It was a big, big deal, this transition into having databases. And it made Web 2.0 possible. Because not only could the person, you know, the webmaster make content, but then anyone could make content. You no longer needed to know how to write HTML. You could allow all kinds of people to add content to your website. You could be Flickr, and the universe could add photos. They could add files as well as content that went into the database. Having a database on the server was key to Web 2.0. So we're now in a stage where all that same stuff is going to happen on the server. All of this is really important. It's amazing. We're going to keep doing it. And we're sending all of that stuff down to our tablets and our phones and our laptops and our big giant machines, all kinds of different devices. The new thing, this new API, it's actually like three APIs, four maybe, is databases on the client side. Databases in the devices. So that you can have databases on the servers, and we'll definitely be using a lot of databases on the servers, but you can also have databases locally on each device. There's a database inside your iPad, a database inside your laptop, a database inside your phone. You can see it here. This is one flavor in particular, but you can see it here where it's just very simple. You just add, you know, you type in, you just fill out this form, you put in two different values, you hit save, and I can see that it's not saving it to the server. It's not making a network connection at all, necessarily. It's saving it in the browser, in on the hard drive locally, or on the flash drive, whatever, solid state drive locally. And you can inspect and see what's going on with this database. This happens to be a very simple SQL-style database. There's a couple flavors. One is web storage, where you can do key-value pairs, if you know what that is. Just, it's like two columns on an Excel spreadsheet. Name, what's your name? Email address, what's your email address? Phone number, what's your phone number? Local storage does it across sessions. Session storage will do it just for that session, which means if you close the browser or quit the browser, the data will disappear in a poof. So it's just there temporarily. Or you can have it stored there for a longer period of time, so it hangs out even though the computer crashed, computer starts over. There's different ways it can be set up. And there's IndexedDB, or originally WebSQL, which has been kind of retired. But IndexedDB is a much more complicated way. You can have an entire relational database. So as crazy and complicated as databases can be on the server, you can have those kind of crazy complicated databases in the browser itself, on the person's local computer. So then the question is, well, what are we going to use this for? Right? That's the question of the day. What are we going to use this stuff for? There's all kinds of ways that maybe you want to save data, let the user of your website save data, save what they're doing, without necessarily making a network connection. I don't know if you've ever been commenting on a website. You're filling out the comment, you're taking an hour to, like, you know, write a really good, and then you have a kernel panic, or your computer crashes, or your macOS Lion refreshes the window, and it turns white, and then it comes back, and all your stuff, like, it's gone, or you're making a WordPress post. Now, WordPress has, like, an autosave feature in it. It will, like, automatically save every minute or whatever, but it's saving it to the data, to the network, up to your website, so you need to be online for that to happen. You need to be able to have that network connection open. What if it's saving locally, and it's just sort of keeping this little scratch pad and keeping track of what you're doing locally and just storing that information? There's going to be some really cool possibilities with storage where you can save things. And this is the edge of where, like, I don't know what those ideas are yet. I feel like that's our job, everybody, to start figuring out what do we want to use this stuff for. Application cache is another one. There's an assumption, right, from Web 1.0, from 1991, that in order to be on the web, you have to be online. Right? You have to have a network connection. You have to dial up your modem. You have to log into AOL. You have to use your CompuServe account. You've got to, like, if you're not online, you're in airplane mode on the airplane, you're not on the web, right? Not anymore. Application cache is a way in which you can make a file, this little special file, called a manifest file, that goes with your website. It's basically a list of all the stuff that you want your website to download to your user's computer for them to have. So when they make the HTTP request, they get the HTML and then get some CSS and some JavaScript. Those are files that end up on your computer. And they could stay on your computer. Have you ever opened up a browser window and you're going to go on a trip like to South by Southwest and you open up like the blog posts you want to read, there's like 7 of them, and you put them in separate tabs, and you carefully close your laptop, and you're like, okay, please stay there. And you go and you get on the plane, and you open it up, and you're like, I wonder if they'll still be there. Because you want to read them on the plane, right? Instead of having that kind of stuff happen, you can have the website save locally. And you might want to do that for, thus the name, an application. Maybe it's a little like Etherpad where people are going to use it. It's a tool. So all the files for that tool are downloaded into the computer. The person's sitting there. They're using their little Etherpad thing. They're offline. There's a database. You use AppCache and the databases together very, very well. And they can be working away, and it's saving locally. And there's all this stuff going on, and they close their window. They quit their browser. Their computer crashes. They walk away. They go somewhere else. They open it back up a month later. It's still there if you program it this way. They can go to click the URL. They're offline. They click the URL. They go to the website, and they can sit there and open up the document they were working on and keep working on it, all without having a network connection. And I think that this is especially important these days because you never know with these network connections. These cell phones, we're using the phone and the data goes down. Just now this demo failed because I didn't have a network connection. They come and go so quickly. And someone might be sitting there with their thing and they're typing and they're doing cool stuff, and then they go to push a button and it fails. And it fails and they lost everything because nothing is local, right? AppCache can help change that. We talked a lot about, again with Peter Lubbers, because he's so smart, AppCache and local storage, and went into a lot of nerdy details about local storage and some other things on the very first episode of the Web Ahead. So AppCache, local storage, storage in general. Then there's files. So one of the things about the web is that it seems very separate from your computer. You open a web browser, and you're using your web browser, and you're inside this window, and you're doing things that feels like you're doing this little through a little tunnel to the internet, and it's separate from your computer. And then you like close that, and you come over here, and you like open up your files, and you grab this photo that you took, and you open up Photoshop, and you start manipulating it, and then you save it, and you're like, if you're a web developer especially, you probably have 4, 5, 6, 7 programs opening, and you're doing this file over here, and then you export for web, and you go over here, and you're in your code program, and you're over here in this other program, and you got all these files, and you're like going between applications and between all this stuff with files on computers. It feels much more dynamic, right? And part of the argument that we have these days about web app versus native app, right? Should we make a website, or should we make an app and put it in the store for your iOS or for Android? Like, which is better? Part of the advantage of applications, an application on a Mac or a PC, is that it has access to the file system. It has real access to what's going on with the files on the computer. You're making things, you're saving them. You have saved stuff, you open it, you manipulate it, you put it back. And the web has really been separate from that. The web was really, it was for reading, right? So you're like reading. Well, there's a group, several different groups of people who are very interested in changing this dynamic and making it possible so that the web can really do things with files. And there's a bunch of different specs. The file API, the file reader, file writer, file system, blob URLs, drag and drop. But together, especially together, these all have the potential to really do something interesting, where a website can, instead of just take, because what do we do with websites and files right now, right? You email attachments, upload buttons. So I have a photo, I want to upload it to Instagram, to Flickr. I have a PDF, I want to email it to somebody. And for a long time, it was a very rudimentary kind of button that you would click, and then would bring down one of those browser things, and you'd like find the file, and you'd hit save, and it would upload it. Drag and drop gives you something more dynamic, where you can like grab the file, and you can drag it in over to the web page and drop it and then be able to upload it more easily. And we've started, you've seen stuff like that in Google Docs or in Gmail, right? Those things were not native to the browser. Those things were sort of add-ons that you need a team like they have at Google, or a big team, big millions of dollars to be able to do those things. This would really bake some of that technology straight into the browser so that it's available for everyone to use on their website without having, you know, $500,000 budget to make that work. But not only can you make it much easier to attach or upload, but you can take a file, like let's say an image file, and you have a web application that's local, that you've gone to a website, and now that whole website is like stored on your computer, and you take this file, and the website actually can open the file. Not just hold the, it's not like it's in an envelope, and it's like this sealed envelope, do not open until, you know, you've arrived. Like it just, it's being that the browser, the website is able to just like take this envelope. It can open up the package and get out the contents of that package and understand what it is. Understand that, oh, that's an image, huh, okay. Let me display that. And now let me give you some brightness controls and let me give you some color controls. Just like Photoshop opens the file and understands the file, the website could be programmed to do that, to understand the file itself. There's been a little bit of that on the server side, like, oh, I'm gonna upload an Excel spreadsheet. And by the time it gets to the server can open the Excel spreadsheet, read the data, and take that data and stick it into the website, into the content management system, sort of parse that data. This is an ability for it to really, that sort of technology to be baked right into the website itself, so that the browser can be like, oh, I know, that's an Excel spreadsheet. Here, let me get that all that content out of there for you and stick it into the content management system. It's hard in a way to talk about this. I find it hard to talk about because it's so much of a stretch from where we are to where we're going to be. I don't quite understand what is up with it. You know, I don't really know where it's going to take us. But episode 14, you can listen to tons of information about this stuff. And then device APIs. Device APIs are a lot of people have been talking about these. We need to be able to get access to the stuff that's going on this device in our web browser, where I can shoot a photo and then take that photo and upload it because the website is able to access photos on the phone. Or I need a way to, I want my website to know whether or not the audio volume is on. I want my website to know, to be able to vibrate the phone so that something happens on the website and the phone can vibrate. Vibration API was just put into WebKit last week or the week before. A lot of people were very excited about it. Like, hey, Vibration API is now in WebKit. Pretty soon we're going to start being able to use it so that, I don't know, your website, you've got it's reminders, you know, is Basecamp or something, and you want to be able to remind people, but instead of simply sending a notification through email, like, hey, I'm sending you an email that you need to do this thing, it's due, it could vibrate your phone. And there's lots and lots of others. There's a whole page about device APIs that you can go to and check out what they are. Battery status, contacts API, which would reach the address book, calendar API, media capture, media API, like video and everything, sensor API, like acceleration, rotation, orientation, microphone. There's a giant demand for getting those kinds of, the ability to get your website to communicate with these devices that are so much more powerful than the traditional laptop or desktop computer. You can check out this list at this URL, device APIs. Then one more is WebGL. So each one of those screens, those are all screens, vertical, they're turned on their side, and they're all displaying websites. That's a web page over and over and over again and over again. Web pages. And then there's fish being drawn by WebGL, maybe some shaders. It's 3D animation, the kind of technology that they use to make a movie over at Pixar, make a movie over at Disney, right? They've been using this technology to make something like Monsters, Inc. You can now use that, or will soon be able to. Coming soon in a browser near you is that same kind of technology. And this is using WebSocket as well, so that the fish can swim from one screen to another screen. And this to me, like, that's a website. That's not a series of pages in a brochure rack. So what are we gonna do with that? Right? Like, I don't know. A lot of people are interested in using that for games and such. I think that makes a lot of sense. I wonder how else we might use it in things that are not games and other kinds of activity on the web. And then, of course, there's a whole TBA. All of this is changing so fast. It feels like there are a lot of ideas of things that we want and things that we want to happen and want to be able to have happen. And we're taking there's a lot of energy in implementing them, a lot of energy in making those things actually to really figure out what those specifications are going to be, and then to get the browser makers to put those specifications into the browsers. And then there'll be years of us figuring out what to design for that and how to implement it and where is it easy and where is it not quite as fabulous as we thought it would be. And but it feels like as we start to actually get through that, we start to do those things, we're going to keep going, and we'll be able to imagine what the next phase is and the next phase. We'll figure out what the limitations of a lot of those things are, the things that are new right now, and we'll start to say, oh, okay, well, here's the new limit. Let's go further. Let's change it. Let's add this. Let's add that. Especially as these browsers end up on devices all over the place. You have a browser on your refrigerator. You have a browser in your TV. You have a browser in your car. This is not an open web standard. This is not a part of the W3C or the WCAG or anything. This is just a company that came up with this. This is vehicle API, and perhaps someday it will become an open web standard. But it's a whole bunch of stuff for data to come out of a car, out of a vehicle, and get sent off to a website or to a bunch of wherever, internet stuff. So things like, what does a check engine light mean anyway? Instead of just displaying a light and having me go to my mechanic, it could send the information, that code, through an API, if it got adapted industry-wide, to a website that I go to when I'm home and I look up what's going on. Or maybe it could record fuel data for me and keep track of how much gas I put in the car and when, and send me information about how many miles I'm driving and what my mileage and my fuel efficiency is from place to place and week to week. Your car is generating data. There could be an API that captures that data and sends it off somewhere, right? Like, it's just another example of this kind of crazy idea, like, oh, vehicle API, yeah, we need that for the web. So it feels a lot like a big question mark. Where is this all going to take us? Paul Lloyd said at one point on Twitter, there are too many web designers not designing for the web. And I feel like this is going to be more true than ever, that the web itself is becoming something that it never was before. It made a lot of sense to use tools like Photoshop to make final decisions about websites, to communicate to business leaders and, you know, stakeholders, the ones who are making this, yes, that's what we want to do, to send over, you know, static pictures of web pages. It was frustrating for a while, I think, for developers, because you'd say, okay, well, we only have Verdana, Georgia, Arial. You just put crazy awesome font into your Photoshop document because you have it on your website, you know, on your computer, but you can't do that. Let me explain to you again that the web doesn't have... Now that's changed. Now there are fonts on the web. But for a while, there was that tension because there wasn't, you know... Or you'd be like, okay, that's great. That looks like an awesome design. It's really pretty, but could you please explain to me what we're supposed to do with hover styling? We need to style the hovers, right? With progressive enhancement and responsive web design and CSS animations, there's a big push to say, we can still use Photoshop. They're still great tools. But at some point, we need to get things into a dynamic situation, into a prototype, into a way that we can see it on multiple devices. We can see it in the movement, the motion. We can see what's going to happen as things happen across time. We can play with it. We can turn the orientation of the device and see how the website morphs. I think that's going to be more true than ever as some of these APIs come along, that the web itself is going to become something that's very different than it was in the first decade or two. And this happens a lot with new technologies. It happened with film, where filmmaking was, you know, a lot of the original films were motion pictures. People would shoot movies that were basically a still photograph moving. Because, of course, that's what you do with a photo camera. You shoot a photo. It's cool because it's moving. It took decades, many, many decades, to figure out that the movement of the camera and even just a push, pushing the camera in, creates emotion that changes the feeling for the people who are watching it, and that those kinds of the techniques of how you move the camera in space will change the very nature of what's happening with the art, or that the edit that you could cut from one edit to another edit and create something that wasn't there, that you have piece of film A and piece of film B, but when you put A and B together, you create C, like out of nothing, where people think something happened and it didn't actually happen on film, but they think it happened because of the way you cut them together. There's things that are part of the nature of filmmaking that took many, many decades for people to figure out that that's what film is. And I think that's happening with the web. It's going to take us a while to figure out what is the web, really. And these things are really pushing us off into the future, off into something else. An innovator is not someone who creates something amazing out of nothing. I think sometimes we get this idea that, like, if you have the most awesome idea ever, you'll have this awesome startup. I think that an innovator really is someone who wakes up to the constraints caused by false assumptions and breaks out of them. And this is an era right now where we have a lot of false assumptions because of our legacy and where we've come from. A lot of these train tracks and a lot of these tunnels that have been built for really good reasons, and they work very successfully. But the constraints have actually changed, and there's a bunch of new stuff out there. And I feel like the people who are able to kind of wake up to those assumptions, the false assumptions now, and imagine and have a vision for something completely different are the ones that are just going to make the most amazing websites. That 5 years from now, 10 years from now, will be like, did you see this? This, oh, look at that. It hasn't happened yet, but it's going to happen. Again, I'll pimp for the last time the web ahead. If you want to learn more about this, this is where I'm just taking the opportunity to like Skype up some of the most brilliant people who know far more about this stuff than I do, and just ask them a bazillion questions for as long as I can hold their attention, because I feel like it's a time where we really need to help each other out. There's so much to learn. There needs to be a way for us to kind of grok what's happening and share that knowledge as a group. So thanks. I think we have about 10 minutes for questions if we want to do some questions. You can also send me questions on Twitter if you want to. I think there's some mics, people with mics. Maybe if you want to ask a question, do you guys want to do run around, or do you want people to come stand up and line up? Okay, they're going to run around.
Hi, thank you for your talk. Do you see the role of designers and developers blurring as we move forward?
So do I see the role of designers and developers blurring? I do. And I think that what is really, really important is for teams. I think we've been working in this world where, like, a lot of business people get together with a bunch of designers and have this really complicated process that has evolved over 20 years to figure out what the website is. And then they codify that into a series of documents, and they kind of, like, chuck the documents over this wall, and they land on the developers. And the developers are like, ah, really? Okay, that's awesome. Wait, what? And there's like this lack of communication. There's just kind of this wall. And I think that wall needs to go away. I think it's really going to hurt anybody who wants to make something awesome. And the more that the developers can be involved early in the process, and the more that the designers can help iterate the final decisions as the development happens, I think the more successful projects will be. And I think that we're going to start to see a bit of like companies that make that transition into a different working process and companies that don't. And I think the results of their processes are going to become more and more different and obvious. I think anywhere that you can really get your designers and your developers together, or get people who know a little bit of both, who kind of know a lot about development, but not, you know, designers who know, understand, maybe they can't write the code, maybe they don't know the JavaScript for writing these APIs into using the APIs and web, whatever, but they can think about it. That there needs to be a lot of conversations and communications. And to be like, hey, I saw this cool thing. Is there a reason we should use that? What do you think about that? Because otherwise, I don't know how we're going to figure this out.
Basically, I'm just wondering how this is going to affect kind of crawling the web, because there's a lot of things about HTML5 which are going to make, you know, search engines such as Google, you know, it's going to make crawling the web much, much easier, like some of the semantic markup. But some of the things you've discussed today, like Twitter, for example, are very, very difficult to crawl. So I'm just wondering what your opinions are on kind of how that's going to affect things for discovering all this awesome new technology.
So how are we going to crawl websites and their content and catalog them and know what they are?
Yes. I mean, one example with Twitter, for example, is they obviously have to have a data agreement with Google because it's so difficult to crawl.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a big concern. You know, we start to see sites like Twitter or others where the website itself is not really HTML at all. It's just this empty container, and then all the content is loaded in later. And I think we need to be really careful about doing that, because we don't want to get away from what was so completely awesome and made the web disrupt every business in the world. We want to leverage that. But then how do you, like, Google search for fish swimming around? I don't know. I have no idea. But I do think that all the best practices that we've been doing, it's not about throwing them away. It's about saying, okay, well, how do we build on that? Or where might we be going? Or how can we take the lessons from of progressive enhancement or whatever and sort of use those to help us figure out what to do next? Because HTML is really important, and having content that you can crawl or that you can distribute to, you know, oh, this person's using Instapart paper, this one's using Flipboard, this one's using whatever.
Hi, quick question. You know, it seems to me like we're going back to, and we've almost come full circle in terms of how application development is occurring. So it's, I'm wondering if the browser will eventually just become irrelevant.
Will the browser become
irrelevant?
Like,
in other words, we're just going to have a bunch of client apps loaded on a device, and those apps will interact together and with web servers.
Yeah, I mean, will the browser become irrelevant? I feel like in a way, this idea that we need to use apps, you know, we need more and more apps, we need, especially when you're thinking about iOS apps. I feel like in a way that is going to go away as the browser becomes more and more powerful, because the browser will be able to do a lot of the things that you can't do with apps right now. You can't do it with the browser right now, so you reach for an app because you need an app. But in the future, if the browser can do it, well, you reach for the app as quickly, I don't know. And I also feel like, you know, apps are all in their little walled gardens. They're all separate. And if you have any sort of like, oh, I'm on Twitter and I made a link and I want to click on the link and go to the content and see the content and then send it over here and send the link through this to my, you can't do that with apps. But also, you know, it's a giant, giant debate, and we have lots of nerd wars about like, oh, app, no, web, oh, no, web is dead. No, web is better than ever. And we don't know, you know, we'll find out. So in 10 years we'll know. But I feel like this really is return of the web being the most awesome, right? It's kind of the, like, yeah, apps, whatever, we're stealing all your ideas, and we're making them part of the web. And what's also interesting, like with File API is making the web be able to do all this stuff with files at the same moment that, like, the operating system on all of these iOS devices especially, but probably all the other ones too, the mobile devices, it's getting rid of the file metaphor and the whole idea of files. So what is that? So finally the web is going to be able to totally catch up to the computer OS and do all this stuff with files, but we don't do that with files anymore. Files are irrelevant. Only geeks and nerds use files, and normal people don't even know what they are. And it's all in the cloud. It's all data and databases, and it's data in the cloud and data locally, and it's just data and APIs. It's not files anymore. So I don't know. Sir?
Yeah, on my current project, we've made a lot of the process changes that you talk about. I'm a developer. I was brought in very early on the project, worked very closely with the UX people, worked very closely with the designers, and built out prototypes very early to, rather than showing the client PSDs and Photoshop and stuff, we showed them working prototypes. And we found that this worked very well, but as we've gone on in the process, we've reverted to the old form of showing PSDs because of the lack of time and pressure from the client to show more progress, because it takes longer to build out a prototype than it does for a designer to just build out the PSD. Do you have any thoughts on how to address that? Where is it about? Do we need to be changing client expectations on how long it takes us to show them what we're doing, or is there, you know, something we can do to speed up the process of building the prototypes, or do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think it's both. I think that we're getting all these tools furiously. People every day on GitHub, they're making another tool to make prototyping faster. And I think prototyping will become... I think each of us as well are like creating, even as a designer, creating a little code library that you sort of start a self-starter kit for yourself so that you can get to something a little quicker. But I also think that it's all about, like, this is the best way to do it. Let's change our process. Oh, wait, yeah, that didn't quite work. Let's change it again. Okay, well, this situation with this client, we need to revert back to an older technique because we want to shift them culturally, but it's not going to happen right now. And then this thing is due, and there's only so much budget. And the reality is, you know, I think that's got to be normal. And I feel like it's both. I think we need to change client expectations, or we need to change the expectations of the business interests and the stakeholders, but we also need to, I don't know, just make it work. Like Tim Gunn, just like, make it work. You got a deadline, just make it work. Use whatever, Grapple, Photoshop, doesn't matter, just make it work. Yeah.
So, similar to the other question, but from the other side, I look at the existence of file API and the existence of device APIs as an existential threat to the need for apps, with the only possible opposing factors being performance and security, where performance is a matter of time until hardware catches up to make performance irrelevant. How will actually security get in the way, or will it not get in the way?
Good question. So performance, like with WebGL, you can really grind people's processors, and that's definitely a place where things need to catch up. I think some of these other APIs, like WebSocket, the performance is crazy, where you can, like that Kazing demo with like 27 bazillion things updating all the time, I can open that up and have that running in the background all day, and it doesn't matter. Where if that had been built in Flash, I'd be crashing because of the memory leaks and how hard it is to do it that way. Security, there's some very interesting things around, because security is a big deal with a lot of this stuff, like WebSockets. You can just get any two websites to talk to each other and just communicate information. Like, that's going to be awesome until my website gets taken down. So there's been a lot of work done around security. There's another API that I didn't talk about called cross-origin communication that lets different origins communicate with each other, and you can kind of whitelist the origins that are allowed. So an origin would be a domain name, like example.com. It'd be a subdomain, like files.example.com, audio.example.com. It'd be other kinds of like pieces of that URL, where you can be like, okay, these four sites can talk to each other, no problem. We know them. That's cool. No one else is allowed in. That hasn't been possible before. That's been part of the problem with all of this, is that there's like this really big security problem, and if you start to do some of this, you might get taken down, so you stop doing it. Or like, that's been such a problem for such a long time that people, really, really smart people, are like sick of the workarounds and wanting to just make it work. And in fact, the team that was working on cross-origin communication figured out some stuff, and then, like, WebSocket was insecure for a little while. They figured out some security flaws in WebSocket. They were like, okay, let's close these flaws up. And they're like, oh, hey, those are probably in Flash, too. So they go over and they look at Flash, and sure enough, the exact same security flaw was in Flash. They got it fixed in WebSocket because it's an open web standard. It's still in Flash. So in that way, I think because of web standards and the agility and the like tons of eyeballs on things, I think we're going to be good on security. I think there's time for one more quick question.
Just real quickly, as you're describing the way that the web APIs and with all the device APIs, the file APIs, everything are evolving, you're almost getting into the point where it's an interpretive language that allows it to go across multi-platforms, and you have the bridge then between the local with the file APIs and the web with the cloud APIs to the point where you've got a transportable interpretive, because it has to go through the browser, language of itself, and becomes less about the web and more just a transportable platform.
Yes. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for coming.